Look good.
Hello, everyone. Could just take our seats. We'll start the session. This is Capital One, and this is Stories of Resistance, Consciousness, Conscience, and the Constitution. And as soon as everyone takes their seats here, I would like to introduce Kjerstin Lyon. She's our moderator for today. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I must say it's a distinct pleasure to be able to introduce this panel, and thank you all for coming. Our plan for today is to have each speaker give their story of resistance, and each one is very different and very unique. I'll introduce each one before they speak so they can have their own time and their own story, and then at the end I'll give you a few brief comments about how we might think about how these stories intersect and interrelate. And then I'll open it up to you for questions. We'll begin with Yosh Kuramiya. Yosh was born in Sierra Madre, California in 1923. His family later moved to Monrovia, where he attended grammar school, junior high school, and high school. He was attending Pasadena Junior College when World War II broke out with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And he, along with his family, along with hundreds of other Japanese families in the San Gabriel Valley, were incarcerated at Pomona Fairgrounds and later shipped to Heart Mountain. His story, which he wishes to share with you this afternoon, is about the events that followed and how they brought about his realization that patriotism can be expressed in many ways. But our dedication to the U.S. Constitution can best be expressed through the persistent exercise of the principles upon which this country was based. So please join me in welcoming Yosh Kuramiya.
February 19th, 1942, the day that should live in infamy. It was the day that President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, allowing military authorities to exclude anyone from anywhere without trial nor hearings. It led to the removal of all Japanese Americans, citizens and aliens alike, from the West Coast and into concentration camps in the interior of our country. We lost our businesses, our possessions, our homes, our friends, and neighbors. However, it was not the material losses nor the physical deprivation that was so devastating. It was the humiliation that was the most demoralizing and had the most lasting effect. I was 19 years old and was attending junior college as an art major. I had no interest in social or political issues. I had learned to accept racial prejudice and unfair discrimination as a matter of course, something we could do nothing about and must learn to live with. I was taught not to make waves. We were first sent to an assembly center at the Pomona Fairgrounds in Los Angeles County. Later, we were shipped by train to the Badlands of Wyoming. They called it Heart Mountain. The mountain was there, but the heart would be forever elusive. There were over 10,000 Japanese faces in this concentration camp, and we knew there were over 100,000 more in 9 other similar camps scattered within the bowels of America, land of the free. Our world had shrunk to the 1 mile square confines of a barbed wire fence. Our family name was replaced with a family number. Something was seriously amiss. Then came the final blow. While still confined with our civil rights suspended, we were required to serve military duty in a racially segregated combat unit. This, while our parents are held as hostages in the concentration camps to ensure our military performance overseas. It was hailed by some in our community as a wonderful opportunity to prove our loyalty. due to the lack of protest, the issue of constitutional abuses by the government had been reduced to the question of my loyalty. It was time to set my sketch pad aside and face reality. The Heart Mound 63 bears this distinction as the only organized draft resistance group of all the 10 camps. This is largely attributable to the pre-existence of the Fair Play Committee, the FPC, a group formed a year earlier in 1943 as a forum to address civil rights issues resulting from our unwarranted abduction and detention. My initial purpose in attending the FPC meeting was to elicit information about the moral and legal justification for our continued detention without hearings nor trial. I was also seeking what recourse we might have when, while still under such duress, we are ordered to fulfill the same military obligations as citizens enjoying the freedoms denied us. It was after our keepers the War Relocation Authority would provide no answers and would only remind us of the dire consequences of disobeying government orders that we, as a group, voted to individually ignore the notices to report for pre-induction exams in order to contest the issue in a court of law. I don't know how many members decided to comply with the orders rather than risk a term in prison. But 63 of us, including myself, did resist, and we had our test case. The pro-administration and pro-JACL Japanese American Citizens League camp newspaper, the Heart Mountain Sentinel, was especially vicious in its editorial attacks, accusing the FPC leaders of treason against our country and betraying our people. It characterized the members, me, as deluded, dim-witted cowards, allowing ourselves to be manipulated by the troublemaking leaders. They scoffed at any suggestion that we were exercising our rights of dissent under the protection of the U.S. Constitution. While awaiting trial in the Cheyenne County Jail, six of us, apparently selected at random, were notified we had two visitors who wished to interview us. This was odd, I thought, as we were previously denied visitations from our families and friends by order of the prosecuting attorney. Why then were these strangers given access to us for an interview without the presence of our attorney? I was led to a small room where I sat alone for over an hour. Finally, a guard came and led me to yet another room, bare except for a long table at which sat two men in suits and ties on one side and an empty chair on the side nearest me. I sat down while the two introduced themselves as Joe Grant Masaoka and Min Yasui, both names familiar to me as prominent JACL leaders. I didn't introduce myself, as they already had my whole 20-year history and that of my family in front of them. I then realized this was not just about me, and it was not a friendly interview. It was an interrogation. After a half-hearted attempt to advise me of the futility of my naive expectations, they questioned me about what influence the Fair Play Committee had in my decision to oppose the draft. They wanted specifics, names, and statements. I suggested the JACL surely had spies at every FPC meeting. Why did they need me to confirm what they already knew? Could it be they were proposing a plea bargain in exchange for my testimony in the upcoming trial of the FPC leaders? When it became obvious I would not join them in their game of junior G-men for the government, they abruptly ended the session by proclaiming I was headed for prison and would be shunned by my community for years to come. They would personally see to that. On the very first day of our trial, Judge Kennedy addressed the 63 of us as "you Jap boys." We all looked at each other in disbelief and were too startled to utter any boos. We knew then that things would not go well for us. It was apparent Judge T. Blake Kennedy, a self-professed racist, would be happy to rid his great state of Wyoming of the scourge the federal government had foisted on them by catapulting us into the prisons of some other state, perhaps somewhere back to the West Coast. Prosecuting Attorney Carl Sackett cleverly maneuvered the proceedings into the narrow issue of, did we or did we not knowingly and deliberately disregard the pre-induction notices for a physical exam? Of course we did. How else could we publicize our predicament and the unconstitutional imprisonment of our people? Defense Counsel Samuel Menon persistently questioned the applicability of the Selective Service Law due to our prior state of incarceration. He failed, however, to cite the specific provision in the Selective Service Act of 1940, which would have substantiated his claims. In its section on classification, paragraph 346, it states, and I quote, "Class 4F, A, in Class 4F shall be placed any registrant who, and under item number 5, is being detained in the custody of any criminal jurisdiction or other civil authority," end of quote. We were, in fact, being detained by the War Relocation Authority, a civil authority. It would seem the draft board was in violation of the classification procedures in every instance where an internee was classified 1A, eligible for conscription, instead of 4F, ineligible for conscription. Therefore, those inducted into the armed forces from the camps were not draftees. It seems they had unwittingly volunteered. This revelation would be especially tragic for those who were inducted reluctantly and never returned. Perhaps the many monuments memorializing those killed in action have a much more heartrending story to tell than Japanese America, especially those who promoted military service as a form of ethnic redemption, would care to admit. Due to time constraints, I'll spare you further examples of a judicial proceeding hopelessly entangled in its own ignorance and arrogance. At one point, even the American flag seemed to lose its color and shed a few tears. Not surprisingly, we were found guilty and were sentenced to 3 years in prison. In spite of our convictions, the second group of 22 resistors from Heart Mountain followed in our footsteps. They had no hopes of winning, of course, but acted on principle and as a symbolic gesture of unity in defiance of Judge Kennedy's court as an insult to the U.S. Constitution. A few weeks later, 7 leaders of the Fair Play Committee were indicted in the very same courtroom. Surprisingly, an 8th person was included in the indictments. James Omura, the then English section editor of the Denver Rocky Shimpo. He had never set foot in any of the relocation camps and had never met any of the resistors or FPC leaders, but had supported in principle our protest in his editorials. James Omura had been a harsh critic of the JACL and staunch, if solitary, defender of Japanese-American civil rights from the inception when the threat of our removal and detention first arose. He was the lone voice expressing outrage at the Tolan Committee hearings, opposing the JACL stance of unconditional cooperation as a preemption of citizens' rights and therefore constitutionally questionable. Has the Gestapo come to America, he queried, a question that was never answered, but would earn him the unabated venom of the JACL for the rest of his life. He was exonerated of all charges under the statute of freedom of the press, but his journalistic career was destroyed by the continued harassment of the JACL. The other seven FBC leaders were convicted, but their convictions were later reversed by an appellate court. So what? These events happened over 60 years ago, and we must be getting pretty weary of hearing all the self-serving sob stories, mine included. The U.S. Constitution is under fire today, as it was in 1942, and as in 1942, no one seems to be doing anything about it. All our World War II stories seem to be about the U.S. Constitution failing to protect our rights as citizens. Yet, how many of us step forward to defend the Constitution in its hour of need? Oddly enough, the sole exception today is a Japanese American. First Lieutenant Aaron Watada is sacrificing his substantial military standing by following his conscience and refusing participation in a war he believes is constitutionally and morally corrupt. Where does Japanese America stand? After our experience in World War II, are we still naive enough to believe our government can do no wrong? Does Japanese America still feel an overwhelming need to prove our loyalty? And yes, Jimmy, the Gestapo has come to America. If we are to learn anything from the horrendous experience of our people during World War II, it is that of the fundamental responsibility of every citizen to protect our U.S. Constitution through the exercise of the basic humanitarian tenets our country was founded on. We may pledge our allegiance to constitutional principles, but it is only through our actions that we can fulfill that pledge and transform our ideals into our reality. This is not about leadership nor heroism. It is about plain ordinary citizens like you and I, even if I happen to be a dim-witted chat boy. And we must assert our dedication to democratic principles, not in spite of EO 9066 and the Patriots Act, but because of them. Thank you.
If any of you have room, if you can just slide in a little bit and make some room along the aisles. We have some people standing in the back who might like to have a seat. Thank you. Next on our program is Morgan Yamanaka. Mr. Yamanaka was born in San Francisco 80 years ago. From age 2 to 7, he was brought up by his maternal grandmother in a farming village in Kagoshima. He returned to San Francisco not knowing one word of English. As a 17-year-old senior in high school, he was caught in a dilemma of having two citizenships, citizenship in Japan and citizenship in the United States. He was first interned in Santa Anita Assembly Center, but in between the time of the bombing of Pearl Harbor and his internment, he made a decision to renounce his Japanese citizenship. When he went to Topaz, he was asked to fill out a loyalty questionnaire. His answer deemed him disloyal, and he was transferred to Tule Lake. He was released in 1946 and then returned to San Francisco, but in the meantime, he renounced his U.S. citizenship. So for a moment, for a couple of years during the war, he remained stateless. He continued his education after the war in City College in San Francisco, where he received degrees in sociology and social work at UC Berkeley. He worked for 44 years at San Francisco State University and retired as Emeritus Professor of Social Work in 2006. Please join me in welcoming Morgan Yamanaka.
I would like to put some body into my introduction. In order to do this, I would like to share a personality and my personality and my perspective on what happened subsequent to my being born 84 years ago in San Francisco, at which time my father registered me with the Japanese consulate, which gave me a Japanese citizenship. No big deal at that time, and really was no big deal until later, which I will describe. At age 2, with my 2 older brothers, 3 years and 6 years older, I was essentially sent to Japan for my Japanese education, traditional training. And at age 7, 5 years, which is important because the U.S. government labeled anybody who was in Japan for 5 years as a kibei. Well, I was a kibei from 2 to 7 years old and received Japanese indoctrination of that period. My other 2 brothers, yes, no question, which I will cover shortly. So at age 7, I returned to the United States to join my natural family, and without a word of English, I was enrolled in the Pacific Heights Grammar School, Grant Elementary School. Only Nisei in my class, no speaker of English. I was essentially classified as a retarded because I couldn't understand anything. And they did a math test, which shows what intellectual ability is, and my math was way up there. So they advanced me way up there, but no English, retarded, so they dropped me back. And they essentially didn't know what to do with me. Several years ago, a Mexican-American youth had the same classification of language difficulty being classified retarded. This is 60, 80 years later. Stupid. Anyway. Not knowing what to do with me, they sent me to my age group class. And in that manner, without a word of English, I did learn English, excellent English, because I was in the all-white neighborhood, wealthy neighborhood of Pacific Heights in San Francisco, where my parents were domestic servants. So that's why I lived up there. And in this manner, I graduated Grant School and went on to Lowell High School, which some of you may know as one of the better schools, high schools. Okay, so in this way then, I went to public school and did fairly well, I think. I'm not the brightest guy, I know this, after going through 8 years of Berkeley and knowing how bright people can be. But my social life was completely in Japantown. I went to Japanese language school every afternoon. Every Sunday was taken up at the Japanese temple, Buddhist temple, with Sunday school and service and following social activities. I took martial arts along with my brother, who took kendo and judo. I took yawara, which is a version of Okinawa karate. If you could picture Kagoshima, Japan, southern tip of Japan next to Okinawa. So we handle some of the karate techniques. In other words, I was exposed to a great deal of Japanese culture. In addition, we had, some of you may know the word, butsudan, the Buddhist temple, Buddhist altar, with a family history, etc. But in our family, we had a large picture of Meiji Tendo, Emperor Meiji. And this is what we worshipped every morning, when my mother would put the new rice of the day and water. Those of you who are familiar with the butsudang. My sister, who was born while we were in Japan, was now receiving her education in piano lesson, Japanese classical dancing, tea ceremony. My mother taught flower arrangement and tea ceremony. My father was probably one of the most knowledgeable person in Japanese arts, along with a specialty in Japanese swords. As a matter of fact, World War II evacuation said all Brownie cameras and Japanese swords were contraband. So I helped my father bring 107 Japanese swords to the police station. So it was in this setting then I was brought up, heavily influenced by the Japanese tradition. Thus, World War II, December 7th, 1941 comes around, and then my brother and I said, what the hell are we going to do? Japanese citizenship, American citizenship by birth, two countries' citizenship at war. And I think this is where my Japanese cultural education, the concept of giri, G-I-R-I, a sort of honorable responsibility, honorable duty. And my brother and I, even without much discussion, we said we'll throw away our Japanese citizenship and become American. This was January of 1942, 1 month before Executive Order 9066. My birthday is April 14th. April 7th, my family was told to go into camp, and we were sent to Santa Anita Assembly Center, where the barbed wire fence, we could not go out. And I hear somebody used to drive around on the other side of the Assembly Center and look at those crazy Japanese in the camp. That was 3 weeks later, he was in camp too. So here I was in camp. Now, behind barbed wire, horse stable, those of you who went to other session, I lived in the horse stable at Santa Anita Assembly Center, and as it was described in the session earlier, it really stank of horses. And we live in that setting of approximately 19,000 ethnic Japanese. I never saw so many Japs in my life. Okay, so I have to kind of... And in that setting then, as I said, April 14th is my birthday. I registered for the Selective Service. As an athlete in high school, I thought I would go immediately into the Army. Got a 4C classification. You know, 4C?
Enemy
alien. Then a group of us started talking about, gee, what's going on here? And then the question to that was answered by the government helping us by saying, answer your question 2728. Will you swear loyalty to the United States? Well, hell, I just renounced my Japanese citizenship. Will you go into the military? Of course, I just signed up for Selective Service. But hell, I was in camp. So the logical answer at that time to me was no, no. And that was only 5% of the 70,000 plus Nisei who did this. Everybody outside, yes, yes. And so as a result of no, no, there was a very logical sequence. Renounced my American citizenship because it really didn't mean much at that point. Well, then actions followed which had no more control. I was now a no-no troublemaker, disloyal to the United States, off to the lake. I hear your friends or your friends were building stockades. They built a stockade within Tule Lake for real troublemakers like me, who didn't know what the hell was going on in terms of trouble. What? I'm sorry. So I was stuck in a stockade. I happened to be the youngest person in the stockade. I had now just turned 18, pushing 19. Out of 19,000 no-no and the families, 200 plus people were stuck in the stockades along with me. And I knew most of them were real troublemakers. They were leaders of the Hoshodang, etc. It was also very interesting to me that some of those Hoshodang people, leaders, had never renounced their American citizenship. It shows what people say and do are quite different. In that setting then, in the stockades, we were treated rather roughly, to say the least. We went through a 7-day hunger strike. Well, hunger strike is only meaningful if the other side accepts the concept of hunger strike. The famous Mr. Gandhi. The British government accepted the idea of a hunger strike. In our case, the military said, if you want to eat, there's your food. That was it. And in 7 days, some of the weak, physically weaker people start getting weaker, and they were taken to the hospitals. At that time, we didn't know where they were being taken. In 7 days, we gave up. At other kinds of stockade experiences were, I remember staying in the snow in barefoot zori, light clothes, in the snow, completely surrounded by American soldiers in battle gear, with a machine gun trained at us, 30 milligram machine gun. Nothing you could do about it, just stand there. At midnight, raids were common, and I think one of the few times I was scared in my life was when a young GI with a submachine gun aimed at my stomach was shivering out of fear. There's another experience in my life where I was questioned in the classic third degree manner. You're roughly handed from a bright room, pushed into a dark room, completely dark, pushed down on a chair, and then one light comes from the top. You've seen the caricatures of this. And then fire questions. I remember questions being fired at me, and then the rest of that experience is completely blank. My brother, who went through it, told me he had been beaten by rubber hose and all. But for myself, I just don't remember anything about that experience. So there were experiences in my life. Anyway, 2.5 months later, military said, okay, go home. Go home mean outside the main camp. And somehow we endured that experience. And for another 3 years, in March of 1946, 6 months after the surrender, unconditional surrender of Japan, we were told, go out, you're free. And within 3 weeks, the whole WRA concentration camp experience was closed. And so that is my experience as a no-no, resistor, renunciant. And how you look at that, I think, would depend upon your perspective. My perspective was, I could have just as easily said yes, yes. I could have just as easily have volunteered for the army, which many of my friends did. Why I did what I did, I leave it up to you.
Our last speaker is Hideo Yonenaka. Hideo Yonenaka was born in 1926 and grew up on a strawberry farm. Due to the alien land law, his family moved to a new location every 4 years. From May 8, 1942 to May 13, 1946, He was incarcerated in the following concentration camps, first at the Tanforan Assembly Center, then at Topaz. Later, he was transferred to Tule Lake, and finally, well, I shouldn't say finally, next to Bismarck, North Dakota, and then finally to Santa Fe, New Mexico. So his experience really crosses over all of the different assembly centers, concentration camps, and Department of Justice camps. Dr. Yoninaka earned a BA in zoology after the war from the University of California, Berkeley, an MA in bacteriology, and a PhD in microbial physiology from the University of Southern California. He received a postdoctorate studies, included Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation and University of California at Santa Barbara. He served in the United States Army at the Army Chemical Center in Edgewood, Maryland. Dr. Yoninaka was a microbiology and biology instructor at San Francisco State University until his retirement in 1994. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Yoninaka.
Good afternoon, everyone. My story is a little different from most people. On May 8, 1942, I was incarcerated at Tanforan Racetrack. I was very angry on this day because it was one day before the high school league track finals, and I had qualified for some of the events, and I thought I had a pretty good chance. The other reason was that I was going to lose my freedom behind a barbed wire fence. However, while I was at Tanforan, I made a lot of new friends. I learned a lot from the Issei's and the Nisei's. I learned to cope with things and how not to be angry at the world. I learned to watercolor and also wood carve from the Issei's. And so life to me was not as bad as I think it could have been. From Tanforan, we were moved to Topaz, Utah. And again at Topaz, I worked at the commissary just to pass the time of day delivering food to the different mess halls, but mainly went to high school and played sports and was a typical teenager. But my life took a drastic change in February of 1943 while I was at Topaz, Utah. That was the day the loyalty oath came out, and my father decided that our family should stay together. And that to stay together meant that our family would vote no, no to questions 27 and 28. His reason for voting no, no, no to question 27 was that he was 62 years old. He had two brothers in the Japanese Navy, and he just could not envision going to war against his own brothers. His answer no to question 28 was based on the fact that if he said yes, he would in essence give up his citizenship, his Japanese citizenship. This would then make him an alien without any country affiliation because he could not become a naturalized citizen of the United States. I sort of argued with my father about this. I was 16 at that time. And I said, if we answer no, I'm sure we're going to be deported. Well, family decision is stay together. So My sister and I voted no, no. You have to remember that there was a lot of conflict between many Japanese families. Conflict between the Iseis and the Niseis because of the cultural differences. But family loyalty was very important to us. And because of this loyalty, Niseis went along with the decision of their Issei parents. Because of this, I voted no, no. Following this, my life changed drastically. Friends who used to play with me began to shun me. They thought I was a traitor and very disloyal. Issei's, who used to greet me, would now turn their back to me whenever I would try to greet them. And it was like I was a traitor and had very few friends at Topaz. However, there were a few yes, yes people who still were very friendly, and to this day, I appreciate their friendship. From Topaz, the no-nos were sent to Tule Lake. At Tule Lake, it was highly political. But being a teenager, I just concentrated on going to high school, playing sports, and trying to enjoy my life, not to think of consequences down the road. There was a rather political group called the Seinendan, the Hoshi Seinendan. And I joined this group mainly for their exercise program. 6 o'clock in the morning, we would get up, do our exercises, and then a half hour later, we would jog around the perimeter of the camp, chanting Washoi, Washoi, which upset quite a few people because we woke a lot of people up about 6:30 in the morning.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. I think the authorities were rather upset, and I read accounts that we were goose-stepping around the camp. I know the difference between goose-stepping and jogging, and we were jogging. One day, my father came to me and said, they need someone to run the mimeo machine in the Seinendan office. And I says, okay, nothing, something else to occupy my mind, so I volunteered. And I would go in once a week to run the mimeo machine. Some of you younger people don't know what it is. It's one of those ink drilling things, very messy. But everything was printed in Japanese, and I couldn't read Japanese, so I didn't pay much attention to it. But later on, I learned that it was very political. Today, I am very aware of what I'm involved in. I read everything I get into. But that at that time, I didn't pay any attention to it, which got me into trouble a little later. A lot of events following that has been blocked from my mind, and I really did not piece together what had happened to me until July of 2000 when I received my file from the Department of Justice. And as I looked at that, I said, oh my God, I was pretty bad because of the events that had transpired. The Issei's and the Kibe's, who were no-nos, were rumored, there was a rumor in camp that the Issei's and the Kibe's would be separated from the Nisei's, that they would be repatriated while the Nisei's would stay in the United States. And so, in order for our family to stay together, a decision had to be made. My parents could not become naturalized citizen, so to stay together as a family, it meant that my sister and I had to renounce our citizenship. Excuse me. This was a very tough decision for my sister and me, because if we renounced our citizenship, this means that we would become people without a country. We were not Japanese citizen. And so if we renounced our U.S. citizenship, we now become an alien without a country. But to keep family unity, my sister and I decided that we would renounce our citizenship to keep the family together. Well, to make renouncing your citizenship easy, on July 1st, 1944, President Roosevelt signed Public Law 405, which amended the Nationality Act, and this law was passed by the 78th Congress, enabling U.S. citizenship to renounce their U.S. citizens to renounce their citizenship. This is quite a change from the Nationality Act, because the Nationality Act states that an American citizen could only renounce citizenship by applying to consul abroad. But to make it easier for the Nisei's to renounce their citizenship, Public Law 405 was enacted. It was then my sister and I, along with 5,500 other Nisei's, renounced our citizenship. When I turned 18, I registered for the draft. Naturally, I was classified 4C, enemy alien. On February 12, 1945, after baseball practice, I was taking a shower and came back to our room, and I noticed two burly gentlemen in our room, and they said, "Get dressed, you're under arrest, you're being sent to another camp." And I said, "What for?" And they said, "Just be quiet, get dressed, and get into that Jeep." I was being arrested with no reason given, besides the fact that they called me an enemy alien. I thought at that moment, my sister and I renounced our citizenship so that our family could be intact. But here, now, I am being sent away from the family, and so much for family unity. When we got to Bismarck, North Dakota on February 14, 1945, it was bitterly cold. And we were assigned to a two-story brick building, and our room had about 30 double bunk steel beds, and I was fortunate to get an upper bunk near a window near a steam radiator. So I saw sun, daylight, and I had warmth. At Bismarck, I tried to keep busy by learning as much as I could from the Issei's and the Kibbe's. And I was fortunate to meet a German prisoner of war named Hans. Hans was an outstanding soccer player, and he would try to teach me to play soccer, and I would try to teach him to play softball. I also tried speaking to him in German, since I took 2 years of German in high school, and he would reply to me in excellent English and correct my German. Quite a teacher. I enjoyed my encounter with Hans, but since he was classified a prisoner of war, I figured I was also a prisoner of war at Bismarck, North Dakota. At Bismarck, the time came where people who had signed for repatriation were actually repatriated to Japan. On November 21st, first group was repatriated. On December 26, 1945, the second group. And in these two groups were most of my friends. So here I was with hardly any friend in Bismarck. I was lonely, no friends, and I did not know what was happening to my family, because all my letters to and from my family were censored. Key phrases were either cut out or blacked out. So you would see a letter sometimes. I would get a letter from my father that would say, "Dear Hideo, sincerely, your father." Yeah, what else was there? I didn't know. And so because of this condition, I kept wondering, what's happening to my family? Where are they? What are they doing? And my friends who were in Japan, where were they? It was at this time that I was interviewed by a Justice Department officer. And in this interview, he asked the following four questions. Is it your own desire to go to Japan? Answer: not really. I don't know the country. I don't know anyone there. And I'm doing this because I figure my family's going to be there. Question: would you be able to survive on your own in Japan? Answer: I think so. I would have to. Question: what are your long-term goals? Answer: get a college degree and go from there. Last question: in which country do you think you will be successful? Answer: the United States, because I know the language, I'll be able to get a job, I will be able to go to college. In Japan, I would have to learn the language, be able to take the high school equivalency, then get into a college. So naturally, I can survive here. At the conclusion of this interview, I figured he was trying to tell me that possibly my family had changed their mind from the censored letters that I had received. And so I asked for non-repatriation and I was granted non-repatriation after that and sent to Santa Fe, New Mexico. I have a note to wrap it up, so I would like to wrap this up. When I got home on May 16th, it was 4 years after being incarcerated, again, I realized how my life had changed. And if you could possibly give me 2 minutes, I think this is a very important point that I would like to make. When I got back, I met a friend, and we were happy to see each other, and we talked about what had happened to each of us. He invited me to a poker party and said friends from Topaz would be there. I went, and two of the people shook my hand and said hi. The other four sort of mumbled hi and said, let's play poker. So I sat down, and during the next half hour, they did not acknowledge my presence or say a word to me. And I knew when I was being shunned. So after 30 minutes, I got up and left. I think this is when I first learned that I was considered an outcast. It took me quite a while to get my confidence back in order to make friends again. And together, my family of friends involved people from the academic community, people from the Concord Church of San Francisco, Los Angeles, friends of my wife and my children. And gradually, I began to get confidence in myself again. I would like to close this by saying, I was angry and bitter for a few years after my incarceration. But my mother and Reverend Fukuda of the San Francisco Church always said to me, it is all right to get angry, but get over it. Learn from it, because when you're angry, your mind becomes cloudy and confused. You cannot make sensible decisions. Get over being angry. Clear your mind. Learn from this incident. And get on with your life. Today, I have overcome my anger and bitterness. I am at peace with myself.
Keep my comments very brief because I know you have comments and questions of your own. I was asked to bring these three stories together. They're all very different, but they all have many things in common, and I'll point out three of them. One is that each one of these men participated in and were a part of organized resistance. The Heart Mountain Fair Play Committee is often recognized as the only organized draft resistance movement among all of the camps. And of course, there were draft resistors in many of the camps, but they organized and they really took to heart James Amuro's comment that let us not be rash. If we are going to resist the draft, if we are going to stand on this principle, we must be organized, we must be principled, and we must stand on the Constitution. And they did that. In Topaz, a year earlier, a less known organized resistance took place. Every single block of citizens got together and took a vote. Will they register or will they not? Kibe voted to register so that they could have the opportunity to vote no. and register their complaint about their treatment by the American government and their vote of no confidence, as their citizenship obviously was just a farce. The Nisei were not so convinced. They battled, they argued, they had conference and meeting after meeting. They eventually decided that as a camp, they would refuse registration. They closed down registration for a week. The director of the camp called up the closest army fort, Fort Douglas, and said, "We have a problem here. Stay on high alert. We might need military intervention." He called the War Relocation Authority. They sent backup. He was advised. He went and met with the citizens Nisei and Kibe, and he told them, after they told him that they refused to register, he said, if you do not follow the order of your government as citizens, you'll be charged with espionage. It's your decision now. It splintered the group. But many continued on with their plan to vote no-no or to resist in other ways. Each of these men was a victim in many ways of a constitution that was threatened. Yosh Kuramiya should not have been eligible for the draft, as he pointed out. Research has shown that people detained in civilian centers should not have been eligible for the draft, and so he was correct in his resistance. Morgan Yamanaka was put in the stockades with no precedent and no charges and held without any kind of legal basis. And Hideo Yonenaka was sent to Bismarck with no charges being held against him and no explanation and no due process. And as Yosh Kuramiya pointed out, our constitution is being threatened even today in some of these very same ways. Finally, each of these men, their resistance and the larger resistance movement that they were a part of was combated with something that I have noticed in my own research, which is patriotism has become and was then a tool of repression. Patriotism was used to combat repression and, to combat protest and to shut it down. In Topaz, for example, when the leaders, the Issei leaders, called on the ACLU to send a lawyer to advise them of their rights, the headquarters of the ACLU asked that they not bring in this lawyer. The director of Topaz said, "We don't want you to come. You're going to inflame an already tense situation." Abraham Lincoln Warren said, "I'm coming anyway. I already said I'm coming. I'm on my way. You can't stop me." 3 days after his arrival, after he was confined only to speak with those who had invited him and forbidden from signing anyone up for test cases, a war hero was brought in to counteract whatever kind of emotions that the lawyer may have stirred up in the people at Topaz. The same thing happened with Yosh Kuramiya at Heart Mountain. The same war hero, Ben Kuroki, was brought in to try and counteract the protest. And he was put on the witness list, although he was never asked to testify against the Heart Mountain resistors. Patriotism was used as a tool of repression. And even today, patriotism is used as a tool to diminish dissent. I'd like to turn the time over to you all to ask questions and make comments. This session is being recorded, and so I'll ask you to speak loudly, or you're welcome to come up and I'll bring the mic down. So who has comments or questions?
Exact word were that he felt it took more courage was just so involved with what everyone else in Hawaii was doing. And he felt that by resisting, you guys were not only isolating yourselves from your own government, but from much of the other Japanese American community. And his feeling, and I'm not sure, is that the resistors were ostracized to the point of shame in our past. So my question is, what sense do you have of where we are today with reconciling these difficult emotions within our community? The arguments between my dad and these two men were like lifelong family friends, and the friendships ended over this. It got so heated that it affected all of our families too. My father still feels to this day, he's at the end of his life, but he felt very strongly that the resistors should be honored for standing up more directly for the constitutional rights than he did.
Would any of you like to comment?
Sorry, I couldn't quite understand the question or the statement of the young man. Can you rephrase it on the microphone?
The question was, where are we at in reconciling the wounds that were created in the community, the ostracization that happened against the resistors of all kinds during the war? Where are we at today in reconciling that?
Well, my own personal feeling is I wish there were more people like your father. Because I think Japanese America in general is going through a period, a very important period of transition. And I attribute a lot of this to the younger generations, of course, that were denied the experience of our Issei generation. What they got through the silence was that whatever happened to us, we should just forget about it and let it go, and that's the honorable thing to do, thereby denying ourselves a clarification of what was really happening. And the Nisseis got so caught up in our own sense of vulnerability, and it gave a very distorted picture of the Nisei generation, which I think is really tragic. But I'm happy to see that things are beginning to turn around now. Does that answer your question, or is that just a lot of...
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I think because of conferences like this, and that the younger generation, the Nikkeis, are being made aware of all the hardships that many people have gone through, that the feeling is changing. Like, I feel a lot more accepted in the Japanese community now, but about 20, 30 years ago, I was a total outcast. When people who saw me wouldn't even say hello to me, I mean, that's bad. But today, I feel that it's changing a lot due to the educational process.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
No, it's not a question, it's a comment.
Can you come up and use the mic?
Thanks.
As far as I was concerned, I think a lot of the changes came around during the civil rights period. And some of the radical students at San Francisco State University, where these two were, formed the Third World Coalition to have a strike for the beginning of ethnic studies there. And it was because of actions like that that they started to speak up about the experiences of the Niseis, who hardly talked to them about their experiences during World War II. So I attribute a lot to the Sansei of the of the early 70s for this beginning of this changeover.
Those of you who do not know Jim Hirabayashi, he, during the time he was talking about, he was the dean of the ethnic studies. So he was really involved in it. And after being at San Francisco State for 44 years, I'm quite aware of that period and the feelings and attitudes which the students had in general, including the Asian students. I was teaching a course called Concentration Camp USA. It was very popular at that time.
Okay, I'm going to ask permission from our JANA representative. Can we take a couple more comments if you keep them brief? Okay, thank you.
My name is Nancy Taniguchi. I teach at California State University Stanislaus, and I taught a class on the Japanese American internment last winter. And Dan Kubo, my friend who's sitting right here, was one of our many guest speakers who came and spoke about his father, who was a resistor. And unlike any other university class I've ever taught, and I've taught there, next year will be my 20th year, members of the Japanese American community just drifted in to listen to the guest speakers. And Greg Maritani from San Francisco came and attended half the classes. He's in charge of education for the JACL to find out these stories. And what I want to say is I want to thank you so much for continuing to tell your stories, and Dan, for telling your father's stories, because one of the things I noticed, you were followed by another group of guest speakers, which included veteran. They hadn't realized what the resistors went through, and their attitudes were changing last January when people finally got a chance to hear other stories. And that was the problem with the shunning. It set up a wall. And for whatever reason, beginning with the civil rights movement and continuing with the Sansei and whoever's doing this, it's breaking down that wall. We're all hearing each other's stories. And that is one of the main things that I think is changing the attitudes, not only in the Japanese American community, but in the greater community at large. And I want to thank you so much for continuing to tell us what happened.
My name is Satsuki Ina. You know, I think that this paradigm, this idea of loyal versus non-loyal or disloyal, is part of our victimization. That was the paradigm that was imposed on us. And when each one of us breaks out of thinking someone was loyal and someone was disloyal, is when we start to get out of camp. So the invitation for people to tell their different stories without the judgment of who was loyal and disloyal, because as I've said before, you know, we didn't have a crisis of loyalty. That was an issue that was poised upon us by the government to justify what they did to us. So we had a crisis of faith in our government. And when we stop splitting, then we'll be free. Thank you.
Last comment.
Mine is a very short statement. When we were celebrating the 60th anniversary or commemoration of the signing of Executive Order 9066, the City and County of Denver asked the JACL to put on an exhibit, and I did that for the JACL. The reason I'm telling you this story is because the question was, what was the condition today? In 2002, when I was doing this exhibit, I included the resistors in the different panels that I had set up, photographs and so on. I got criticized by four different JACL members for including them. And I said, how can we not include them? This is part of the Japanese American experience, and that we should be ashamed for not having acknowledged them and their courage. So I just wanted to point out that there are sentiments yet today, and I think that this kind of presentation will help dispel that, but I think that we have to all work on it. And I think Satsuki's comment was absolutely appropriate. Thank you.
There are two other statements signed by Franklin Roosevelt, a special executive order limited only